Hello everyone, welcome to the sixth episode of the AJSP Editors Podcast. As you may know, it is a new initiative we started last year, and now it is the second episode of the year of 2022. We have two objectives in this series. First of all, to introduce publications in the journal to the global social psychology community. And second, to nurture next generation of Asian social psychologists. In each episode, we have two sections. The first section is editor's pick, and the second one is special topic discussion. Now, without further delay, let's begin with our editor's pick. Editor's pick a little bit special in the sense that we will cover two papers rather than one. In the issue we just published, we're talking about the June issue. We actually have a big number of articles this time. And we picked two articles because they are related to each other, very, very closely related to each other. And both papers were led by Professor Emiko Kashima from La Trobe University. So they are related. So that's why we discuss them together rather than just pick one of them for discussion. The first one is Social Motives of University Students in Seven Countries, Measurement, Development, and Validation. And the second paper is Exploring the Adaptive Role of Core Social Motives in Perceived Societal Threats. So I will let Sammy and Angela summarize the papers for us and also explain the significance.
Thanks for that introduction, Kevin. I'll start by talking about the article that focuses on the development and validation of a social motive scale. So before we begin, I think it's useful to define what social motives are. And social motives then are the reasons or motives more precisely that we have for embedding ourselves in social networks and engaging with social relationships. So Susan Fiske argues that social motives make people fit better into groups and thereby increasing their chances for survival. And there is a vast body of research that indicates that social connections, both at an interpersonal and group level, are important for health and well-being outcomes. And that means that there are good reasons for us as psychologists to understand what it is that motivates us to form and maintain social connections. So based on an extensive literature review of both empirical research and theories by Stevens and Fiske in 1995, they identified five core social motives. And these dimensions or social motives were corroborated through a review of the literature that was carried out by Emi Kashima and colleagues and is presented in this first article. The first of the five motives is that to belong to groups. The second motive is that to understand groups. And that means to understand the shared meanings within groups. And without this understanding of shared meaning, it would be difficult to function within groups. The third motive is to control, and this involves being able to manage or regulate social relations effectively. The fourth motive is trust, involving mutual tolerance and respect for one another. And the fifth and final motive is esteem. So we become validated in social relationships. Others hold us, and we hold others in positive regard. So taken together, the five social motives are referred to as the bucket framework. And even though there exist measures that assess different aspects of the five social motives, there isn't one that captures all of them. So developing a measure assessing these five social motives was the main purpose of at least this component of the research. I think it's important here to point out that when it comes to development and validation of psychometric scale, this article offers an excellent account of the procedures involved. So the procedures followed in developing and validating this measure are very rigorous, in my opinion. It doesn't only develop and validate a scale within one country with one sample, but with seven samples from seven countries. This included Australia, Austria, New Zealand, and the United States, representing Western countries and cultures, and China, Macau specifically, Malaysia, and the Philippines, representing Eastern countries and cultures. So the first procedure involved formulating items, capturing the five motives. In this step, seven items per motives were formulated and included in the survey. And these were also back translated to three other languages, Cantonese, Malay, and German. In fact, all measures and items included in the survey were back translated to these three languages. So other than formulating items that capture the five social motives, constructs believed to be both proximal and distal to the respective social motives were identified for inclusion in the survey. These constructs then allowed the researchers to assess the convergent and discriminant validity of the social motive scales while also mapping the nomological networks of the social motives. The validation measures included were self-construals, independent versus interdependent, personal need for structure, generalized trust, global self-esteem, and attachment style. So I'm not going to be able to get into the specific rationales for the hypothesis regarding the relationships between the five social motives and the validation constructs, but the rationales for them are very extensive within the paper. So I would recommend everyone to read it to go through how one go upon justifying other measures to be included in a study to be used for validating a measure that's being developed. But to give some examples, interdependent self-construal was hypothesized to be positively associated with all five social motives, whereas independent self-construal was hypothesized to be positively associated with only the control and esteem social motives. The first step in the validation procedure involved an exploratory factor analysis, or what we abbreviate as an EFA. So the EFA showed good convergence, but given that some of the items cross-loaded, some had to be excluded. This resulted in a final set of 20 items, with 4 assessing each of the 5 social motives or subscales of the overall social motive scale. The 20 items loaded neatly onto 5 factors corresponding to the bucket framework in the subsequent EFA, with all items having reasonably high factor loading. Internal consistency values for the subscales, that's Cronbach's alphas, range from good to excellent across all 7 country samples. Having validated the structure of the social motive scales through EFA, the researchers then go on to testing the structures in conformatory factor analysis, or what is often abbreviated as CFAs. The factor structure held up quite nicely in the 7 country samples when using separate CFAs, and then they move on to multi-group CFAs to test for invariance. And these tests indicated that there was equivalence in the factor loadings of the factor structure for the scale across the countries. And this is often referred to as metric invariance. Only partial scalar invariance could be found between the country samples. And this means that the intercepts of the items assessing the subscales only were partly equivalent between the samples. One implication of this is that one has to be quite cautious in comparing mean scores between countries. The findings in terms of association among the social motive subscales showed that they were positively associated with one another in all countries. The belong and esteem dimensions were most strongly associated with one another. The associations between the social motive subscales and the validation measures included in the study were largely in line with the hypothesis. All social motives were positively associated with self-construals, but only control, esteem, and trust were associated with independent self-construals. So the motives to belong and understand were not associated with interdependent self-construals. All social motives were positively associated with personal need for structure. All social motives but the control motive were associated with generalized trust. All social motives were positively associated with attachment anxiety. And only the belong motive was associated with global self-esteem, and that relationship was negative. Other interesting findings from the analysis include that the control motive was the highest in the total sample, whereas the understand motive was the lowest, although there were some different patterns found in the different country samples, and you can read about these patterns in the paper. Social motives were the highest in the Philippines and the lowest in Austria. Overall, social motives were also higher in Eastern compared to Western country samples. Social motives were also higher for women than for men across the samples, with the greatest gender difference found for the belong, esteem, and trust motives. So overall, I think what this paper establishes, and this is just a very quick summary of the paper, is that it establishes the validity of the social motive scale, which is referred to as SMS. And it follows very rigorous procedures for validating a scale cross-culturally. And there are extra steps here involved for validation of scales across or measures across cultures that aren't necessarily included when only when one scale is included and is validated in one country only. And I think those procedures are very important to follow, and different aspects of analysis that are added to scale validation procedures. So what this article or this component of the research allows the researchers to do is to proceed with more inferential analysis, having validated the structure of social motives empirically. And it does that to a really high standard, in my opinion.
Yeah, thanks, Sammy, for the very detailed sharing of the paper. So I guess what would be next is for me to proceed to the second paper, which is also led by Emi Kashima and also the team of colleagues, looking at why the study of social motives is interesting and meaningful. So to me, I think the second paper about societal threats and social motives is extremely interesting, is an excellent demonstration of how we can first show the validity of the scale and then also demonstrate the meaningfulness of the construct. So this research reported in the second paper is a multi-country study involving roughly about 1,500 college students from different countries, including Australia, the US, New Zealand, the Philippines, China, Malaysia, and Austria. So I think this diverse country samples is really one commendable feature of this investigation. So the study aimed to examine the relationship between perceived societal threats and social motives. So why, maybe now your question is, why social motives are important when they are societal threats? So maybe a very brief recap, because Sammy has also shared with us some background of the meaning of social motives. So according to Susan Fiske and colleagues' earlier theorization and research findings, social motives are very important characteristics that can motivate people to connect better with the groups. And therefore, this group collaboration can increase the chances for survival, particularly when the society has a lot of challenging demands. So several social motives were identified, namely belong, understand, control, esteem, and trust, thus giving rise to the bucket model, which was also introduced to us in the first paper that Sammy just shared. So given these core social motives can serve to engage people to collaborate effectively and adaptively to deal with environmental demands, so these social motives are therefore particularly useful to achieve collective regulation and collaboration to help people manage societal threats. So according to the authors, these societal threats, so these challenging demands in the environment, may not be actually present in real time yet. So they may be perceived to eventually materialize in the near future. Therefore, the authors call these ambient societal threats. So the theoretical logic of the research is that under high levels of ambient societal threats, people are more likely to mobilize their social motives to facilitate social connections and also to use their social support in order to build resilience and increase coping success. Therefore, the authors have a few hypotheses. So first, the authors hypothesize that ambient societal threats would be positively related to social motives. And further, they hypothesize that this threat-motive relationship would be even stronger among people with lower global self-esteem. So the reasoning is because for people with lower self-esteem, they do not have a strong sense of personal agency. So they may be more likely to rely on interdependence and social support to help them manage these societal threats. So they expect the relationship between threat and motive will be even stronger for lower self-esteem individuals. So in brief, this multi-country investigation show consistent support for the hypothesized positive relationship between ambient societal threats and social motives. So particularly college students who perceived societal threats to increase in the next 20 years tended to report stronger social motives. So they endorse stronger social motives if they expect in the next 20 years there are more social challenges. And also this positive threat motive association was also stronger among those with lower self-esteem. And as they explained before, because the low self-esteem individuals may need more social support and interdependence to help them manage these societal threats. So this relationship between threat and motive, social motives, would be stronger for lower self-esteem people. And because of time, I cannot mention all the findings in details. So these are the two, I think, the most important and also most interesting results in this research. So I encourage the listeners to have a good read of this very interesting paper. And maybe a bit of sharing of why I think this paper is interesting and is theoretically important. So I think this paper can offer very robust support that our human psyche is very far-sighted and also future-oriented. So we are capable of selecting and adopting motivational tendencies to help us prepare for adverse environments in the foreseeable future. So although these societal threats may not be present yet, it's an ambient social threat, as the authors mentioned, but still people are willing to adopt this kind of social motives to get prepared for the future adverse environments. So I think essentially these social motives can promote the human species' adaptability, resilience, and survival opportunities. Therefore, human beings are both agentic and social beings, and this certainly is evolutionary advantageous. Yeah, so this will be the sharing I want to discuss with you about this second paper.
Thank you, Sammy and Angela, for summarizing the contents of the two papers for us. And as I also mentioned earlier, and as the listeners may be able to tell already, that the two papers are connected to each other. The first paper summarized by Sammy is the development of a scale measuring the social motives. And the second paper summarized by Angela examines, you can say, the implications, right, or the usefulness of the scale for understanding certain psychological phenomena. So I'm just wondering whether Angela, Sammy, if you have anything to add specifically about the connection between the two papers that you want to highlight for the listeners.
I think one important connection between the two papers could be that the second paper on the relationship between societal threats and social motives can really demonstrate the evolutionary utility of social motives. So in the first paper, it kind of showed the validation evidence of the scale measuring social motives, and that is very nicely done. And this second paper can really show a very good case of why the study of social motives is important, particularly is evolutionary important. Social motives are not just individual differences or motivational differences to help people deal with current situations. It can actually facilitate some adaptive strategies to prepare people for future demands that have yet to be materialized. So I think it really speaks to the evolutionary utility and importance of social motives. Yeah, so that's my take on the connection of the two papers.
I would also corroborate that. And I think it's really interesting to see two papers published like that, because I think it really, on the one hand, shows in a very rigorous way what social motives are. And then moving on to the second study or the second article shows the implications of those social motives. And I think it's really original work that opens up for many, many possibilities to study the different implications of different social motives with regard to a range of different social, psychological, cultural outcomes. For me, it represents a really exciting start for empirical research, mapping out social motives and their implications.
Yeah, that's also what I wanted to say, right? Yeah, encourage the readers to listeners to read these two papers together, and then starting with the scale validation paper. I think it's particularly an interesting case for students or early career researchers to examine. It's a kind of like, I would say, kind of like a good example of how, you know, you can develop systematic program research and how you can start with some more basic, you know, work, such as developing a good meshes that allow you then to examine some psychological research questions with a validated tool, right? So that's a really good example of how you can develop research kind of in a systematic and step-by-step manner, right? So do read these two papers together. I think I want to end the editor's pick today with a very brief, kind of sharing from each of us some important directions based on these two papers. To you personally, what is the kind of interesting or important direction for future research? How about Sammy?
I think continuing mapping out the implications of these social motives. So things that came to mind for me that are based on my own interest and where I'm at in my own thinking with regard to social psychological processes is, for example, what social motive specific groups fulfill for individuals that are part of them. So for example, thinking about people that adhere to extremist ideologies and extremist groups, what social motives do they fulfill? So I think it's quite interesting also, and the next step potentially would be to map out needs that one has for social motives and the extent to which they are fulfilled and how different groups fulfill or don't fulfill those social motives and what implications that they have. And another thought that I had when reading about this was with regard to health and well-being outcomes. Do certain, or the fulfillment of social specific social motives have stronger health and well-being outcomes than others? Found that to be a really interesting potential direction for future research to map out whether or not the fulfillment of different social motives have differential health and well-being outcomes.
How about Angela?
Yeah, so I echo Sammy's points about the importance of interventions, just particularly when during these trying times of the pandemic and also climate change. I think it's very important to explore and examine how social motives can help prepare people for all these challenging situations. And actually, in the second part of this podcast, Professor Yingyi Hong and William will talk about conspiracy theories. And in these challenging times, people actually adopt conspiracy theories or beliefs to deal with these challenging situations. So I think it is really beneficial to examine how social motives can help people not to fall under these conspiracy beliefs and try to collaborate together in collective actions to manage all these societal threats. So I think it's important to further examine how we can promote social motives among the communities. And also the current research show that lower self-esteem individuals are more likely to harness benefits of social motives. So maybe future research can also examine for whom else social motives are also more beneficial. And therefore, these people can better realize that social motives can be the psychological tools to help them manage stressful and adverse situations. Yeah, so there are a lot of interesting research inspirations that I can get from reading this paper. So I really encourage listeners to have a thorough read after this podcast.
Yeah, share all the points you just made. Particularly, I was originally thinking about the well-being implications as well, which Sammy already mentioned. It would be quite interesting to see how fulfillment or the failure to fulfill these social motives, kind of implications it has for people's health and mental well-being, right? But definitely, I think it's just because paper is about something very fundamental, the core social motives, so relevant to many different behaviors and phenomena. So that makes the paper very inspiring. Also because it provides a tool that is already validated with a very rigorous method, and that opens up many possibilities. So I do encourage our listeners to read these two papers together. And of course, there are many other papers so interesting in the issue we just published. Well, just speaking, we published a lot of papers in this issue than previous issues. So it may take a little bit longer time to read this issue. But yeah, I do encourage you to pick up the June issue of the journal and then read the articles. So I will conclude the section of After Speak here. And when we come back, we will have the second part of the episode, and that is a special topic discussion. Thank you. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the second session of the podcast episode today, which is, as always, the special topic discussion. And the topic today, I think, is a very important topic and also kind of a hot topic, and that is conspiracy theories. We have two special guests today. Very happy, very honored to have them here. First of all, Professor Yingyi Hong. She is Chou Mingyi Professor of Management at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Well, we all know she's widely acclaimed, widely honored for her academic contributions and services in the field of social psychology and psychology in general. And in fact, we have known Yingyi for a long time, and she has been very supportive all the time for the Asian Journal of Social Psychology. She has been our senior editorial advisor for some years already. So that's our first guest, Professor Yingyi Hong. We call her Yingyi. Most of us call her Yingyi. Is it okay, Yingyi?
Yeah, sure.
All right. And then our second guest, Hoi Wing Chen. Most of us call him William. And William and I know each other very well because we worked together for some years doing his PhD study. He graduated from the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology several years ago. And he also worked with Yingyi for some years at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. And he is now an assistant professor at the Polytechnic University in Hong Kong. And the reasons for us to invite them to join us is that they, together with Professor Karen Douglas from University of Kent, they recently added a special issue on the topic of conspiracy theories about infectious diseases, right? Which is obviously a very timely topic, very interesting topic for the Journal of Pacific Rim Psychology. And we find it, oh, maybe they should be kind of the best persons to have this conversation with us about the concept of conspiracy theories, the psychological research, the trend of these type of research in psychology, etc. Very happy. And actually, I looked forward to this discussion for some time already. So thank you again, Ying-Yip and William, for joining us. All right. So I shall start, as always, with this question, just to allow our listeners and our readers to know a little bit more about our guest, particularly something that they may not be able to find on their CV. So there's always a question I ask. So I ask this question to both of you, okay? The question is simple. So how did you fall in love with social psychology? So how did your journey with social psychology begin? So maybe Ying-Yi can share with us your story first.
Sure. Thanks for inviting us. I think I fell in love with social psychology since childhood. I grew up in a low-income housing estate where crime rate was quite high. So when I was a child, to avoid getting into danger, I need to observe other people's behavior and make predictions of their actions. Mm-hmm. So as such, because of this survival need, I got interested in social psychology. And then later on in college, I was an exchange student to Keio University in Japan. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I was in a class of international students who came from all over the world. I made good friends with a Canadian young lady, but then got into quarrel with her. So it was a really heartbreaking incident for me. I cried for several days. And that's the first time I realized how important cultural beliefs could shape different interpretations of the same actions. Mm-hmm. So that's when I fell in love with cultural psychologies as well. Yeah, So that is my story.
Okay. But this is obviously a story that, I think, you should share with other people, our students, right? To signify that, okay, psychology is so useful. Could be as kind of a part of your survival kit that you really need, right? But then, what Ying-Yi just said is a relatively dangerous environment. Psychology could be very useful. Thanks for sharing, Ying-Yi. And how about William?
Thank you, Calvin. I think I share similar experience with Professor Hong or Ying-Yi. I'm also enchanted by the power of social psychology in understanding different people's behavior, particularly in different contexts. At the beginning, I'm more interested in understanding why people, when they come together, can do something really nonsense or radical. So social psychology gives me the hints that to understand how these could happen. But officially, I begin my social psychology journey actually with Calvin. In my MPhil study, we try to understand how different types of social norms would influence how different parents pass down their values to their kids. And these issues I find especially important for the adaptations of immigrants and ethnic minorities, especially in a multicultural societies like Hong Kong. So since then, I start to think about how social psychology in particular can advance our understanding of some contemporary social problems, such as intergroup conflicts, environmental problems, and even as today, spread of conspiracy theories. So this is how I come to love with social psychology and begins my journey as a researcher in social psychology.
Okay, thanks for sharing. Something I noticed from this conversation with our special guest in previous episodes and also in this special episode is that, it seems they always started with some awareness, some real-world problems that really get us interested in understanding it, be part of the solution of the problem. And then that's where our passion in social psychology kind of developed. Let's go back to the topic of our discussion today, right? The psychology of conspiracy theories. Now, the word conspiracy theories obviously is very often brought up not only in academic research, but also in the media. I think it will be useful for us to start with the definition of it first, right? I'm not quite sure whether the way the term conspiracy is used in the media is it the same or different from how it is used in academic research? So Yingyi and William, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about your definition of conspiracy theory and how is it related to or different from concepts such as disinformation or rumors, etc.
Well, I think it's important to define what conspiracy theory is. And unfortunately, it's not a very simple task to define what it is. This is a well-debated thing in the field as well, also in other social science disciplines. But according to our own observations, we think that there are at least three widely agreed features. So the first feature is that conspiracy theory is an unverified account to explain an event or situation. So it's used to explain something that happens. It could be something critical or something continuous as a process. And it involves some, the second feature is it involves some evil group of people. Simply put, it would be the conspirator that they're trying to do something that supposed to be on the contrary of the interests of the public. So this is the features. It should include an action, intention, or even a plot that is against the interests of the public. So take climate change as an example. The statement, the idea of climate change is created to mislead the public by some corrupted scientists for getting research fundings. So this is a conspiracy theory statement, and it involves all three elements. So these statements obviously explain what climate change is, and involve some scientists as the conspirators, and also it involves a malicious actions, which is the intent to mislead the public for getting some research fundings. So this is conspiracy theories. And then if you consider all these three components together, they can tell the difference between conspiracy theory and disinformation or rumor. So disinformation can be anything that is intended to be faked or misleading. So the goal is to deceive people and for something, to achieve certain gains, for example, political gains. So one of the examples is fake news. So fake news is created on purpose, and the creator knows that it is false, and it is created to mislead the public to fulfill some political or financial interest. It can be a scam or something happening that can impact on the stock market. If it does not involve the all three components of conspiracy theories, then it is not conspiracy theories. But on the contrary, if you consider that if a disinformation has involved all the three essential elements, so it involves the explanations of an event, it involves, say, conspirators, and also involves some malicious actions, then we can consider conspiracy theory as a type of disinformation in this regard. And rumors as even borders, it can be any narratives of unknown truth. So it does not necessarily involve some bad guys doing some bad things or explaining of any events. Again, using climate change as an example, a rumor of climate change could be there are certain carbon absorbing technologies that could be a miracle cure for climate change. So there is no intent to mislead the public, and there's no negative connotations of these statements that involve a malicious groups or intent. So just a statement of unknown truth. So this could be rumors. So there are some difference between all these similar but dissimilar concepts, but they are in different kinds of specificities.
I see. Yeah, I think the three features that you named are, I think, very useful for us to really distinguish conspiracy theories from those related concepts. So as I read, you know, sometimes in the media when people are talking about conspiracy theories, sometimes I'm just not quite sure whether they are really talking about conspiracy theories or actually something else, right? But for us, of course, to do research, we have to define it very clearly. And I think that what William just shared with us will be very useful.
Yeah, thanks, William, for the very clear definition of telling us what is about conspiracy theory. So I guess I have another question for Yingyi and William. So I suppose conspiracy theories, because of its social significance, is very well researched in other social science and behavioral science disciplines, not just psychology. Because in these trying times, we have experienced the pandemic, and also we have introduction of the vaccines for COVID-19, and also the previous conversations that we have talked about climate change in the society, as well as previously we talked about genetically modified food, and now with new technologies, we also talk about necro meat. Right? So all these are very relevant for the study of conspiracy theories. So I want to ask Yingyi and William, the two of you, like what are some special features or strengths of psychological research on the study of conspiracy theories or beliefs? So what are some common research methods psychologists used to understand the psychology of conspiracy theories?
Angela, thanks for the question. Indeed, my observation is that research on conspiracy theory, psychology or not, is rapidly increasing in number in recent years. This seems to follow from the occurrence of many unforeseen mega events in recent years, some of which you have mentioned. Like, for example, the COVID-19 pandemic, climate change, etc. And this might reflect people's need to look for explanations to understand those unexpected events. And interestingly, conspiracy theory as a research topic has attracted interdisciplinary and or multidisciplinary research. For example, studies that combine communication and social psychological approaches have examined many conspiracy narratives, how they evolve and spread in social media, and also how, for example, exposure to those contents would influence people. Another example, political scientists are interested in how political affiliations and political discourse influence people's endorsement of different types of conspiracy theories. And within psychology, we are interested in understanding the motives, cognitive biases, and personality traits that can explain why people cling to certain type of conspiracy theories. And also, we look into situations that would make people more susceptible to conspiracy theories as well. Yeah, you also asked about method. So regarding research methods, I think the most used method is still surveys. So surveys in which participants were asked to rate the extent to which they think a particular conspiracy beliefs or narratives to be true or false, and the extent is believable. Psychologists also conduct experimental studies to test the inference of exposure to conspiracy theories and then observe the consequence for people with different background and personality predispositions. In some recent study, I see that there are research that use big data methodology to analyze the contents and prevalence of different conspiracy narratives spreading in major social media platforms such as Twitter or Reddit, etc. So it's really, you know, now is a booming topic and attracting more and more research from many different disciplines.
Thanks, Yingyi, for sharing with us this recent trends in psychology about the study of conspiracy theories. So I think it's very interesting, as you said, that psychologists have been studying like the dispositions or traits of why some people are more likely to be vulnerable to conspiracy theories and also the situational influence of conspiracy theories. So I can see the potential of studying maybe the person-by-situation interactions, as what Michelle previously introduced to us in personality psychology. So maybe this could be one very prominent direction of studying how the person interacts with the situation to affect people's susceptibility to conspiracy theories and beliefs. So maybe my related question next would be to want to see like how some major theories in psychology can inform us about some interesting findings in the psychological research of conspiracy theories. Maybe something that you and William have observed in the special issue that you can share with us. Maybe pick one or two very interesting findings that we can discuss together.
Thank you, Angela, for the question. So as Ingi mentioned earlier, so the theory is expanding and there are a lot of new things coming up actually. So it's a little bit difficult for us to give a very brief comments here. But I will try to refer to the very big theories proposed by one of our co-editor, Professor Karen Douglas here. So in a comprehensive review that she and her colleagues had did, so they have proposed an overarching framework that tries to explain why people turn to conspiracy theories. So in particular, they perceive that there are actually three types of needs that drive people to turn to conspiracy theories, which are epistemic, existential, and also social needs. epistemic needs are actually our motivation to maintain our understanding, our certainty, consistency, and accuracy in understanding the world. So according to these needs, then we have an urge to search for an answer when something big and uncertain happens, like the COVID-19 pandemic, or the sudden death of a very significant figure, like the assassinations of a president or former president. So conspiracy theories are appealing in these cases because these theories often claim that they have identified some kinds of hidden patterns and the culprits behind the events have already been spotted. So it seems like getting that is stories or something that they can believe or can hold on when something random or uncertain happens. So related to that, research studies actually found that conspiracy beliefs were particularly appealing to individuals who have high need for cognitive quotient, who always need a firm answers, and also a tendency to perceive illusory patterns and agencies. So for people who would have a tendency to identify different patterns, they're also more likely to endorse conspiracy theories. So another need is the existential need, which is our desire to feel safe, secure, and able to exert control over the environment. So conspiracy theories are appealing in this case because they inform people what the sources of dangers and the enemies are. So as I have defined earlier, conspiracy theories always involve the conspirators. So we know who are the bad guys. So it tries to telling us that what kinds of things are dangerous, what kind of people or groups are dangerous. They also allow people to explain their suffering or miserable conditions by externalizing our miserable conditions to these kinds of bad guys, bad peoples. In this sense, research studies have also found that conspiracy beliefs were particularly appealing to people who have a stronger feeling of anxiety, feeling of powerlessness, and also lacking socio-political control. So some researchers also propose that conspiracy theories could have some adaptational functions. So for people who are in vulnerable groups, missing a conspiracy could be very dangerous to their survival. These kinds of peoples, so those are in a powerless positions or lacking socio-political power, they're also likely to endorse conspiracy theories because of that. So the last need is the social need, which is our motivation to maintain a positive social image of ourselves and also the groups we belong. So conspiracy theories are appealing as they make people feel that they're different from the other people. So some people who believe conspiracy theories would call the other guys the sleeping sheep. So they think that they are more smart than those people. So they're more unique in terms of their understanding of the societies. So in this regard, research studies found that conspiracy beliefs were particularly related to a higher narcissism, need for uniqueness, and also a collective narcissism. So it's a group level narcissism. So based on all these findings, Professor Vamparian further proposes an existential threat model to understanding why people turn to conspiracy theories when something bad happens. So this model suggests that existential threat would trigger a sense-making process. So we try to make sense of something bad that happens to us. And this sense-making process would make conspiracy theories more appealing because, as we just said, it provides them some answer. So this is particularly true when there are also antagonistic outgroups. So we know that which groups are the bad guys when some bad things happen. So it's basically their models that integrates all fitness together. So some interesting finding related to that is that recent longitudinal studies didn't find that belief in conspiracy theories could really satisfy these needs. For example, in a recent studies during the COVID-19 period, they found that an increase in conspiracy beliefs did not relate to a decrease in anxiety and feeling of uncertainty. So although these kinds of needs make conspiracy theories more appealing, believing in these conspiracy theories actually cannot reduce their level of anxiety. So in our own study, we also observed that conspiracy beliefs didn't predict increase in control over time, although lacking of control may attract people to endorse conspiracy theories. Another important finding in the theory is that belief in conspiracy theories could bear negative consequences to oneself, to others, and to the societies. Obviously, in one of our papers, that we observed that belief in conspiracy theories could lead to less compliance with COVID-19 pre-disease preventive measures, which is also replicated by different studies as well. We consistently observed that there could be some negative impacts of belief in conspiracy theories on tackling some collective crisis. So another important finding is that anti-vaccine conspiracy theory was really related to a stronger vaccine hesitancy. Some reasons that he's also found that radical conspiracy beliefs, like belief in QAnon conspiracy theories, were also related to a stronger support for radical political actions, or even a stronger intention to participate in non-normative collective actions. I think these are some major findings that I can cite.
Thank you for that excellent overview of theoretical perspectives. I found it to be really informative. We know that you recently edited a special issue on conspiracy theories for the Journal of Pacific Rim Psychology with a focus on infectious diseases, which was published earlier this year. Are you able to give an overall take on the collection of articles published in the special issue and perhaps outline some major conclusions that we can draw from the collection of articles?
Thanks for asking about our special issue. So the title of our special issue is Conspiracy Theory About Infectious Disease, and published in Journal of Pacific Rim Psychology early this year. And it's edited by three of us, including William, Karen Douglas, whose theory William just mentioned, and myself. So the main aim of this special issue is to address the antecedents and consequence of disease-related conspiracy beliefs. So we have included 9 empirical papers in this special issue. And among these papers, one was about conspiracy theories of Zika virus outbreak. And then the remaining 8 papers were about conspiracy theories of the COVID-19 pandemic. Our special issue is quite global. The paper covers samples of participants from 9 countries, including Chile, China, Finland, France, Germany, Italy, South Korea, the UK, and the US. So as you see, it includes both Eastern and Western cultures. So what's the main conclusion? The main conclusion is that belief in COVID-19 conspiracy theories does bear negative consequences for containing the pandemic. Although we are talking about cross-sectional and correlational study mostly, there is consistent negative relationship between COVID-19 conspiracy beliefs and disease preventive measures across multiple studies. So in terms of who would believe conspiracy theories, just, you know, like what William mentioned, we have papers that also replicate that personal narcissism and also national collective narcissism were consistently related to higher conspiracy beliefs. So let me define national collective narcissism is the belief that one's nation is superior and it deserves recognition of its greatness from people in other nations. So it is worth noting that national collective narcissism may orient people to understand the disease outbreak in particular ways. Let me give some examples. For example, one paper in our special issue find that people with higher national collective narcissism perceive their national in-group to be suffering more during the disease outbreak, and therefore they believe stronger in conspiracy theories. In another paper, the author found that people with higher national collective narcissism are more likely to attribute the responsibility of the disease outbreak to outgroup, and thereby are more likely to endorse the conspiracy theories that bring those outgroups. So across all these papers, we find quite consistent patterns in the special issue.
Thank you for kind of reviewing for us, right, the major conclusions in the collection of articles in the special issue you three edited, and also, of course, answering our earlier questions about the psychology of conspiracy theories in general. I want to end the discussion today with a question about something more about future research, right? Instead of reviewing what we already know in the literature. From what you observed, either in the articles, in your special issues, or your general understanding of the psychological research on conspiracy theories, what are the gaps in the research in this area on this topic? Okay, what are the major gaps that you see in the existing research, and And also, of course, what are the major or important directions for future psychological research on conspiracy theories?
Maybe I'll share one of my observations here. So one emerging trend that I see is an increasing number of cross-cultural, cross-national studies in understanding conspiracy theories. Because as we know, the earliest studies are often mainly based on the US samples. So we need to have a broader geographical representation in terms of our understanding of why people believe conspiracy theories, and also how the culture and the socio-ecological context would influence people's endorsement in these kinds of conspiracy theory narratives. So there are emerging studies understanding how cultural factors and also different socio-ecological factors that make people more likely to believe conspiracy theories. I can give some examples here. So they found that collectivism and also economic inequality and also low democracy were related to higher conspiracy beliefs. So as these contexts are related to people's proneness to detect intergroup threats, so you can consider when we have different groups of people and in collectivistic societies, we are likely to categorize ourselves in terms of the groups. So there are more in-group, out-group thinkings here. They're more ready to detect that there's something bad happens that is caused by some out-group people. So under high economic inequality or no democracy, people could also have a heightened feeling of political powerlessness, so especially for ordinary people. So it's like the things are controlled by other peoples out there, so making them more susceptible to conspiracy beliefs. And also high inequality and also a low democracy would relate it to a heightened sense of distrust towards other peoples and institutions, which is also make them more susceptible to conspiracy narratives, because most of the conspiracy narratives are about the elites and the institutions. So it makes them more likely to endorse these kinds of narratives. Overall, I think the inference of these broader contexts still need more research in the future. So there's just a growing number of studies on that. Yeah.
I agree. My observation is similar. Actually, the study of conspiracy theory, I think, is still a young field, at its infancy, but it is getting more and more sophisticated in terms of the theory and method. I observe a few directions. First, researchers are trying to understand different types or carries of conspiracy theories, even towards the same event. For example, there are two types of COVID-related conspiracy theories that many researchers now agree upon. One type of conspiracy belief denies the risk of COVID, such as saying that COVID was just like a common flu, its severity was purposefully exaggerated. And we call this a risk rejection conspiracy. And then another type of conspiracy accepts the risk of COVID, such as saying that COVID is a bioweapon created by some malicious algorithm. So now it's more and more like fine-tuning and also understanding the meaning underlying or the content of all these conspiracy theories and then categorizing them into different types. So second, researchers are trying to understand how situations or contexts make a difference. So this relates back to Angela's point about Walter Mischel's P by S approach. I think indeed, you know, situations are important. I'll give you an example. In a project, William and I find that the risk acceptance type of conspiracy, i.e. COVID is a bioweapon, predicts more disease preventive behaviors in early months of the pandemic. But then the rejection type of conspiracy, that is conspiracy is a hoax, predicts fewer preventive behaviors in later months of the pandemic. So these differential links were mediated by risk perception and negative emotions, and then moderated by stages of the pandemic. So context situation did matter. So I think more and more research might be looking into this as well. And then third, there is still few research that examines how to reduce conspiracy beliefs. So I think there is a gap there. The research in our special issue has shown that a rational thinking style was associated with rejection of COVID-19 conspiracy theories, which was further related to increased compliance with disease preventive behaviors. So this suggests that teaching people rational thinking might help them resist conspiracy theories. And also, in addition, some papers in our special issue point towards out-group brain underlying conspiracy theories. So I think future research could test the causal effect of rational thinking style and better intergroup relations might be in reducing conspiracy beliefs. So I think more experimental research and more research on interventions will be needed.
Thank you, Yingyi and William, for guiding us through not only the existing research, psychological research on conspiracy theories, summarizing major conclusions, introducing to us the major theories, but also, of course, in the very last question, right, pointing out the important directions for future research. And I think listeners would not find it difficult to understand that conspiracy theories obviously is a practically very important research topic. As Yingyi and William discussed earlier, it could bear behavioral consequences like, you know, for example, the engagement in COVID-19 preventive behaviors. I also know of findings suggesting that conspiracy beliefs about climate change predicts people's behavioral engagement, right, in climate action and to what extent they support emissions reduction policies, etc. So obviously, conspiracy theories bear a lot of the behavioral consequences, you know, in response to many of these threats that our society is facing. We are very happy to have Yingyi and William here to, in this special topic and discussion, introducing to us the psychological research on conspiracy theories. I hope it, you know, enhances our listeners' interest in the topic, in a sense, engage more of us in the community on this very exciting and emerging area of research. Unfortunately, time is limited. It's always a case for a special topic discussion. We have to stop here. I have to show my appreciation to Yingyi and William once again for joining this podcast episode today, and of course also for the effort in editing that special issue on infectious disease and conspiracy theories. That was a very useful, very valuable collection of articles there. Thank you, Yingyi and William. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here comes to the end of the episode today. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to meeting you all again in the next episode. Stay tuned. Bye-bye.